Blog Talk Radio.
After the Holocaust, only 10 million were left. 6 million people, innocent men, women, and children, were murdered just for being Jewish. In 2017, there are an estimated 16 million Jews on Earth again. And on January 27th, International Holocaust Remembrance Day, we are strongly encouraging you to remember our past. Let's reach out to 6 million people in honor of each and every Jewish victim. We must remember, because the survivors among us are dwindling. We must remember because now it is our responsibility, along with the children and grandchildren of survivors, to protect our future. We must remember because today, anti-Semitism is on the rise again, all around the world. We must remember because Holocaust deniers are relentless. We must remember because never again seems to happen, again and again. From the Holocaust to the killing fields, Bosnia, Rwanda, Darfur, the Yazidis, and more. We must remember because we owe it to our ancestors and to our children. So please, pick up a pen, a paintbrush, a crayon, and write, "We remember." Photograph yourself and then post your picture on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and use the hashtag, "We remember." Please, don't forget.
We must remember and never forget. Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, and welcome to a very special program today in honor and remembrance of the 6 million Jewish people that perished during World War II. It is a sober, serious, and eye-opening program today. But it is a program dedicated to the Jewish people, to the State of Israel, for the incredible suffering that they endured. And we must never forget, we must always remember. Tomorrow is International Holocaust Remembrance Day officially, but today I'm doing a program so that I can help you as the listener to reach out and remember the 6 million Jews that perished in the gas chambers of Auschwitz and many other places during the horrible time of World War II. Today is an educational program. Today is a day of honoring and remembering the Jewish people and striving, educating, and doing everything I can so that something like this can never be repeated, can never happen again. Anti-Semitism, true, it's on the rise everywhere in many, many countries all over the world. And this program is a program to educate those about this terrific practice that's going on. I'm very, very encouraged by our new president who wants to move the American embassy to Jerusalem and who is reaching out and with real friendship to the state of Israel and to the Jewish people. And so I know very soon, in fact, tomorrow, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will meet with President Donald Trump in Washington. It will be a very exciting time. And I'm so happy that we have a president that cares, reaches out, and recognizes the Jewish people like Donald Trump does. But today, I want us to remember and never forget. I want you to hear this brief little soundbite. It's called Unforgettable. And I want you to hear carefully. These are several Jewish people in this soundbite helping us and educating us about the Holocaust. Let's listen.
We have this crazy idea
that's never been done.
And you can be part of this.
We plan to make a statement that's unforgettable.
To make sure we always remember.
Less than a lifetime ago,
6 million people were murdered
just for being Jewish.
Then we promise never again.
Yes, since the Holocaust, we have seen
the killing fields,
Bosnia,
Rwanda,
Darfur,
and the ongoing tragedy in Syria,
and rising hatred towards
African Americans,
Muslims,
Jews,
and others.
So now we are looking to reach 6 million people who will say,
we remember the past and the people who perished.
By holding these signs and pledging to never forget,
let it be our obligation
to speak up and put down acts of racism,
signs of hatred. So if you have been subjected to horror
or blessed with a peaceful life,
please write, we remember,
and post your picture with the hashtag we remember.
Please, please,
please,
please don't forget.
Don't forget.
Don't forget.
Don't forget.
Don't forget.
A very unforgettable piece. And what we can do, what I will be doing tomorrow on the actual observance of International Holocaust Remembrance Day 2017, is have a little sign that says, we remember, and a picture. And this way, we are flooding the world of the internet with remembrance to stand against racism, to stand against hatred and discrimination. And that's what all of us together can do tomorrow. Post these pictures all over Twitter and Facebook and educate people about one of the most darkest times in history, especially for the Jewish people, one of the most horrific, darkest times. I'm very glad here in St. Louis, that we have a Holocaust museum. In fact, that's where I went at the library a few years ago to research the two books that I've written about the Holocaust, The Promise and Beauty from the Ashes. And I spent some time there getting to know some of the folks at the Holocaust Museum, getting to interact with them, They are wonderful Jewish people. It is a great tour, and I plan very soon to once again go on another tour on a day off and just remember and never forget. Well, today on the Cross in the Desert, we are focusing in on the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which officially begins tomorrow. But today, because of time constraints and other obligations, I could not do this Friday. I always do my program on Thursday. Today, I'm going to educate us. And I want to begin by going way back during World War II in a place called the Warsaw Ghetto, where the Jews had been walled into a small confining place with barbed wire, and the Germans systematically tried to kill them through starvation and disease, and then eventually they were shipped out and deported to the concentration camps. But in the Warsaw Ghetto, where there was so much disease and death and suffering, there was one brave Catholic nun that did everything she could to rescue people and take them out of the ghetto to the other side of the wall. I want you to hear the story this morning of that brave Catholic hero. Her name is Irena Sendler, and this is her story on how she rescued Jewish people. Let's listen.
Irene Sendler was a Polish Catholic nurse who worked in Warsaw during the Nazi occupation. She became known as the Angel of the Warsaw Ghetto for having saved 2,500 Jewish children from certain death. During that time, she worked for the Warsaw Department of Social Well-being, which administered the community soup kitchens throughout the city. She worked tirelessly helping Jews and Catholics. After the creation of the Warsaw Ghetto, Sendler was able to take in the children of many families in order to keep them from being deported to the concentration camps. She transported the children in ambulances as if they were sick from typhus. She hid them in trash cans, tool chests, supply boxes, or coffins, and later she hid them in convents and Catholic homes. She created an archive with the real identities of the children so that one day they could be reunited with their surviving family members. In 1943, she was detained by the Gestapo and taken to prison, where she was brutally tortured. A Divine Mercy Holy Card was found in her cell with the phrase, "Jesus, I trust in Thee," which she kept until 1979, when she gave it to Pope John Paul II as a gift. She never betrayed her mission, and she was sentenced to death, but a soldier freed her thanks to the intervention of the Polish resistance. At the end of the war, she was able to recover her archives. Although most of the families of the children she saved had died in the concentration camps, she placed many of the children in orphanages, and some were sent to Palestine. In 1965, the organization Yad Vashem of Jerusalem granted her the title Righteous Among the Nations. During the last years of her life, she received the thanks of the children she had saved, and she was nominated several times for the Nobel Peace Prize. Irene Sendler died on May 12, 2008, at the age of 98.
I can't say enough good about this tremendous saint who risked her life to rescue children from the Warsaw Ghetto. And she was very smart and intelligent, very courageous lady. And in fact, in my book, The Promise, and then Beauty from the Ashes, I have a character which is very similar to Irena Sendler. And you cannot say enough good about the many, many people during this dark and horrible times who risked their lives to save the Jewish people. One that comes to mind is Oskar Schindler. Everyone, I'm sure, has seen at some time or someplace the movie Schindler's List. And he was another individual that reached out, very courageous man, that did his best to rescue Jewish people from certain death in the concentration camps. Today, I want to feature a few of the survivors and their stories as they remember this dark and horrible time period. And I want to take us now into one of the most well-known camps, one of the most brutal camps, of course, and that is Auschwitz. I want you to hear this little documentary of what life was like there for the average Jewish person. So we're going to hear this special report right now on the Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
It was late at night that we arrived at Auschwitz. Then we were welcomed by a speech from one of those couples. He said, you saw that sign that Arbeit macht frei, that means freedom through labor. He said, don't make any mistakes. Nobody needs your labor here. You did not come here to work. You came here to be killed. We're just waiting your turn.
Auschwitz in many ways symbolizes the epitome of mass industrialized killing by Nazi Germany during the Holocaust. The camp was transformed from a holding place and a place of incarceration for Polish political prisoners into a mass killing center in a few short years. It began its existence in 1940. It was set up by the SS in order to imprison Polish political prisoners. When people were brought to Auschwitz, all their personal property was taken away from them. There was a process of dehumanization that went on there. Prisoners had their heads shaved. They were given uniforms and tattooed. So Auschwitz was the only place in which prisoners were tattooed with numbers. The conditions for living, whether those are in the barracks that were created to house horses, that now housed hundreds of people, often five to six to a bunk.
Here is Auschwitz, they told us. Here you cannot live long. If you live a day or you live 2 days, that's about all how long you live here. The same way, they kept on chasing us, beating us, chasing us, beating us. And I went, they took the pictures of me like a criminal from all ends, odds and ends. And they took my clothing, they told me to put it in a bag where it was written my name. And then we went, they shaved our head. Then always beating, wherever you go, every step.
But then over the course of time, beginning in 1941, it started to undergo some changes as a result of the interest in the SS in using the camp for forced labor for the war effort. And in 1942, it became a killing center. Particularly by 1943, modern methods for disposing of bodies with vast crematoria that were created, new forms of gas chambers that allowed for the destruction of large numbers of human beings. So this was industrialized killing on a grand scale. Between 1942 and the end of 1944, You had almost 1 million Jews killed there, about 75,000 Poles. You had about 24,000 Roma and Sinti, that is Gypsies, 15,000 Soviet prisoners of war, as well as 10,000 to 15,000 political prisoners from a variety of different countries.
Then one morning again, word came to us that we were going to evacuate Auschwitz. Why were we evacuating Auschwitz? It is because the Russians were coming close by. And so we all walked out Auschwitz and we started walking. And we started walking, we walked for days. I'll never forget it. I don't know how many days we walked. We walked, and then we took cattle cars, and then we walked again. And as we walked, we heard gunshots, and they told us to keep on marching. We heard gunshots, and they were shooting people in the back who couldn't keep up with the walking. It ended up being called the Dead March, because the ravines and the gutters, they were all red from blood.
Holocaust memorialization is important for every country in the world. In the United States, this is a country in which many Holocaust survivors went after the war. But it's also important for a museum such as this to be in the United States because it serves as a lasting reminder of some of the perils of being a bystander, of watching as events unfold and not dealing adequately with those.
It is horrific when you are able to actually see the visuals of the soundbite I just played for you. And in my books, The Promise and Beauty from the Ashes, I do my very best to tell this story, this horrible, dark time in history. I went to the International Holocaust Remembrance Day official website, and I came across an article I think is very helpful for you and me to understand why the Holocaust must be taught in the classroom, why people must be educated. And this is absolutely imperative that we do this more often. We need to talk about this in the classroom so students understand what is happening in the world and how to prevent this from happening again. But why do we teach about the Holocaust? Why do we educate it? I want you to hear a few reasons why. Number one, the Holocaust was a watershed event, not only for the 20th century, but also in the entire history of humanity. It was an unprecedented attempt to murder a whole people and to extinguish its culture. The Holocaust should be studied because it fundamentally challenged the foundations of civilization. Number two, a thorough study of the Holocaust helps students think about the use and abuse of power and the roles and responsibilities of individuals, organizations, and nations when confronted with human rights violations. It can heighten awareness of the potential for genocide in the contemporary world. Number three, study of the Holocaust assists students in developing an understanding of the ramifications of prejudice, racism, anti-Semitism, and stereotyping in any society. It helps students develop an awareness of the value of diversity in a pluralistic society and encourages sensitivity to the positions of minorities. Number four, the Holocaust demonstrated how a modern nation could utilize its technological expertise and bureaucratic infrastructure to implement destructive policies ranging from social engineering to genocide. Number five, the Holocaust provides a context for exploring the dangers of remaining silent and indifferent in the face of the oppression of others. Number six, as students gain insight into the many historical, social, religious, political, and economic factors that cumulatively resulted in the Holocaust, they gain awareness of the complexity of the historical process and a perspective on how a convergence of factors can contribute to the disintegration of democratic values. Students come to understand that it is the responsibility of citizens in a democracy to learn to identify the danger signals and know when to react. And number seven, the Holocaust has become a central theme in the culture of many countries. This is reflected in media representation in popular countries, popular culture. Holocaust education can offer students historical knowledge and skills needed to understand and evaluate these cultural manifestations. And these are all very good positive reasons why the Holocaust is studied, why it should be studied in the classroom, and how it can benefit students. There are so many good reasons right there. And I want us to know about this because it doesn't matter what group it is, be it Muslims or anyone else, we can disagree with them politically and theologically, but there is absolutely no toleration for stereotyping them, for doing the things to them in any way that's reflective of what happened in the past and in the history and how the Jews were treated way long ago. But remember something important today on this program. Anti-Semitism is unfortunately still alive and well. And part of the reason I'm doing this program, well, in fact, a big reason, is to stand up against these manifestations of anti-Semitism that are all over Europe and in many countries, and do my best to remind people of the horrific repercussions of when a race is targeted for extinction, like the Jewish race was during World War II. I want us to go back again to the stories of the Jewish people. This one particular story is a happy story. It's the story of liberation, and this is told by a Holocaust survivor. Let's listen to it right now on the cross in the desert.
I had nightmares, of course, for I would say for a couple of months, you know, waking up thinking that I'm still in the camps, and I was so happy that I was in a real bed. In order to have a little bit of pleasure, let's say, which is there's not too much of it in the camps, I made friends with two Polish kids. We didn't get too much sleep, and we used to just get out real early in the morning, because in the barracks it was just crying and screaming and praying, and it wasn't unusual that a prisoner who was laying next to you to go to sleep, when you woke up, they were dead. In any of these camps, everything is so the same day in and day out that when anything unique happens that is not on the schedule, you always immediately try to talk about it. Is this good news or bad news? One morning we came out, and the first thing we saw was that there are no guards in the guard towers. So we are sneaking between the barracks towards the gate, and lo and behold, nobody's there. So we get enough courage to go to the gate, and we notice there's a heavy chain with a padlock on it, and it's a very, very foggy morning, and we are just dumbfounded. All of a sudden, there's a break in the fog, like a mirage, and all you see is two horses with a horseman. As he's coming closer, one of the Polish kids says to me, "Look at his hat," and it was a red star, a Russian soldier. He comes to the gate and he says, "I'm advance guard. Nobody can leave the camp because there are all sorts of diseases. You're full of lice and you haven't been washing for months." But he says, as he takes out his gun, shoots up the padlock, "Doctors will be coming, medication will be coming, food will be coming very shortly." So the three of us, as fast as our skinny legs can carry us, we go to every barrack in the vicinity, open up the door in every language that we know, just yell in, "We are free, we are free." And you'll never forget that moment, the sounds from the barracks. Those who are able to walk out to the sunlight, walk out. Those who can't walk are crawling out. I have to pass through a little area where there are little bungalows. And this is where the SS families were staying. And they must have left in a big hurry, because I go into one of the bungalows and I open up the closet, the clothing in there. Open up the pantry, food. And then I go into the bathroom and I turn on the water, hot water, fluffy towels, shampoo, soap I haven't seen for a year. I make a little victory dance on my prison uniform, get in there and take my first hot shower in a year. It's wonderful. I'm trying to have as many happy moments as possible. At my age, you know, you can't take any chances.
It's an amazing story. Liberation Day. A day that many of the Jewish survivors will never forget, when hope came through the horizon and chased away all of the darkness, and the Soviets liberated many, many of the camps. Well, as I'm thinking about International Holocaust Remembrance Day, I go way back to when I was a young teenager and when I was first introduced to the Jewish people. And it was through the famous Diary of Anne Frank, which to this day is one of my most favorite books of all to read. This is a story that drew my heart toward the Jewish people. It gave me an understanding of the subject of the Holocaust, because as a young teenager, you got so many things on your mind. Why would you want to think about something as horrible as that? But it was because of the Diary of Anne Frank that I was introduced to the Jewish people, to Israel, and to the Holocaust. And there are so many well-known quotes from this diary of this young Jewish girl. We've all heard this quote: in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. That's a quote I will never forget. Anne Frank was trying to put in context the kind of culture she was living in. And she was trying to hope for the best in humanity, but all around her, with the war going on, when they would gather at night and look out the window in the Netherlands, in Holland, where they were staying and hiding, they would see, you know, the air raid sirens, the planes coming over, the bombs dropping. They would see nothing but violence. They would see nothing but killing all around them. And so Anne was trying to find a way to say, surely there are still good people in the world. And in spite of everything, Anne says, I still believe somehow are really good at heart, that there is some good in humanity in spite of all of the evil and the death and destruction brought about by the German people. Well, this is a quote that has always stayed with me, and it's part of my book, The Promise. What I want to do right now is spend a little time taking the story of Anne Frank, and I want to tell you a little bit about that particular story here. Hold on. I think I cut off my blog talk. I don't believe I did this. This I always have worried about happening, but I actually did it, and it's a mistake. It's funny, but I'm going to be okay. Anyway, I closed out the tab for blog talk. I knew I was going to do this one of these days because I got so many tabs up here, so it's kind of humorous, but in a good way. What I want us to do, though, right now on the cross in the desert is to remember Anne Frank. But this story is a little bit more than just about Anne Frank. It's about refugees that were turned away during World War II when they were seeking asylum, and how this applies to refugees today. So this is the story of Anne Frank, but it's also a bigger story. It's a story of refugees. We're going to listen to that story right now on the cross in the desert.
I'm Christina Wren with History Buff at the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, California. Today is a screening of the new documentary, No Asylum, which follows the untold story of the pleas for asylum by the Anne Frank family before World War II, and how many countries, including the United States, refused to accept them as refugees. We were able to sit down with Ava Schloss, the stepsister of Anne Frank, who has since written books about her experiences during and after the war.
Well, Ava, how did you first meet Anne?
I was 11 years old. And one day a little girl came to me, introduced herself, and her name was Anne Frank. Daily, actually, we saw each other and played with each other, like 11, 12-year-old kids do, you know, at the time.
Being so young, you know, at what point did you realize that things were changing within the community?
Well, in May 1940, the German army invaded already. Anne's older sister Margot and my brother Heinz got a call-up notice to be deported to Germany to work in factories. And that was really when I realized it was a matter of life and death.
Anne Frank's father, your stepfather, tirelessly wrote letters to many countries requesting asylum for his family.
Was this something that later in life he ever spoke about?
No, never. Mm-hmm. Never really heard about it, that he was trying to get to America.
Otto Frank's letters requesting asylum were lost in the archives for over 70 years before filmmaker Paula Faust was given access to the documents.
How did this story first come to you?
I have a dear friend, Robert Perry, and he knows Jonathan Brent, who's the director of the Evo Archives in New York, founded by Sigmund Freud and Albert Einstein. And I was given a stack of pamphlets, and I went through them all, and I saw this one, the Otto Frank file, and I found out that Anne Frank's family had been struggling to get out of Europe and save themselves during the Holocaust. And this entire chain of letters, chain of documents of their struggle to try to save themselves was all preserved.
What was it like for you first reading these things and kind of experiencing what on an individual level, someone was going through just to try to help their family survive.
I was very surprised to find out that the Frank family had gone through that, that they, as refugees, were trying to get asylum in any country they could. They were desperate. And they are indicative of millions and millions of people at that time.
The letters are so heartbreaking. The one bit in particular where Otto is saying, essentially, our lives don't matter, but for the children.
It's our children. We want them to grow up in freedom. And then everyone ended up dying in the Frank family except for Otto.
Anne Frank and many others were not granted asylum and were often deliberately given obstacles to slow and even deny their applications for asylum in many countries, including the United States.
People today are surprised when they hear that, you know, the U.S. was not opening its doors to Jews during the Holocaust. Does that surprise you that people aren't aware of that?
It is not something which the American government advertised that they're not. Now, of course, with quite different communication, one knows much more what is going on in the world.
Do you think the reaction would have been different if people would have known?
I don't think so, because at that time in the 40s, America was quite anti-Semitic.
The prejudices and fear facing the Jews during World War II have many similarities to the current Syrian refugee crisis and the experiences of many other refugees around the world.
When people say today that, you know, comparing the refugee crisis to the Holocaust isn't fair, that's not accurate, what would you say to them?
Well, it's a different situation, but it is nevertheless, for those people, for those refugees, it is a life-threatening situation. They have nowhere to live because their house is bombed or things like that. They have no way of earning a living. They have nowhere to get their children to school.
Fear, I think, is what often causes us to behave in ways towards each other that aren't humane. How do we address those fears and remind each other in a time where there are crises and there are things to be afraid of?
In general, we don't have to be afraid. And if we treat those people how they should be treated, like human beings, and not put them in camps and treat them like animals, they will be grateful and will make good citizens in the new country.
This is very current, unfortunately. So to educate ourselves about what happened and to use Anne Frank and her family's example of how they were turned away is important.
Through learning from history, the mistakes are not being remade. But we have learned from history and we still make the same mistakes.
You can follow the film at noasylumfilm.com. I'm Christina Wren for History Buff.
Yes, and education is the key to this entire story. Bet you never heard that story before, how the Frank family were denied asylum. I want to talk just a moment about the subject of refugees in the context of our program today, because anyone that knows me and listens to my radio program and reads any of my books knows immediately that I have a heart for refugees, in particular, Iranian refugees. Now, just yesterday, President Donald Trump did sign an executive order restricting visa travel from certain countries to the United States for the purpose of our security and safety. It's a temporary ban until the entire system, the immigration system, can be revamped, and we need to restructure it to prevent terrorists from coming in and terrorist attacks from happening. One of those restricted countries that has a temporary ban on it is Iran. Now, that certainly is a country that affects me in a very big time way. But as I read the report, I also found out that there is exceptions for those that are fleeing countries like Iran because of religious persecution. They will not be denied visas. So that's good news, because most of my friends that are fleeing Iran are fleeing because of religious persecution. So I'm glad that clause is there for them and any other country that refugees are fleeing from because of religious persecution. They won't be banned and they won't be denied visas. I understand and I support what Donald Trump is doing, President Trump is doing, because he's thinking of the safety and security of our country, and something drastic has to be done. It is not at all discrimination or turning away people. It is simply a temporary measure to get things in order so that we can continue to be a nation that welcomes immigrants. immigrants, but they have to come in legally and they must assimilate to our culture because too many of them have come in, even some legally, and have turned out to be radicalized Muslims, and we have to stop that. And so this is why I support it. So my Iranian friends that are fleeing Iran because of religious persecution will not be denied. There will be no ban on them, and I'm very thankful that that clause is there. Speaking of refugees that weren't allowed in, let's go back in history. Maybe this is a story you've never heard of, but there was a ship on May 13, 1939. 1,000 German Jewish refugees boarded the MS St. Louis in Hamburg, Germany. Their destination, Havana, Cuba. But after a two-week journey on the high seas, the ship was not allowed to dock, and the passengers were not allowed to disembark. Why? Most had bought landing permits in Germany that by Cuban law were no longer considered valid, but they could not return to Germany for fear of concentration camps and certain death. These refugees were homeless. For weeks they sailed, reaching out to world leaders and organizations for help. And finally, in mid-June, they received the glorious news through the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee's European chairman, Maurice Trapper, that Britain, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands would take them in. An amazing historical story. But again, the travesty of politics and paperwork that would have kept these Jewish people from going to a different culture to escape certain death. And it's sad, in one sense, that they were denied entrance. And it's really unheard of that they had to sail around for so many weeks before a committee would come to their aid and allow them into these countries. But again, this is a perspective about refugees. We need to do everything we can to secure our borders, to make things safe, but never, and under any circumstances, turn away refugees. There is a vetting process. There is a legal standpoint that they must go through, and it's a very long, drawn-out process. But in the end, I have a heart for refugees. I want them to come here. I want them to assimilate to my culture, to find freedom, to be able to live out their dreams, because this is what America is, the land of prosperity, democracy, and living out your dreams. So everything I pray will work out and that this temporary ban will be lifted and our system will be fixed and we can safely once again allow in refugees that want to come and live here legally and live here freely. Well, what I want to do on the last remaining minutes of the program today, I want to read to you from my book, Beauty from the Ashes, The Promise Fulfilled. This is the story of two young Jewish girls, Hannah and Rachel, who meet each other 40 years after the Holocaust. And in order to understand the story, you would have to read The Promise. But here in my book, Beauty from the Ashes, Hannah returns to Auschwitz to face the demons that have kept her captive all of her life, to face the fear she's been running from. And I want to read to you from that book, Chapter 13, Return to Auschwitz. The dark rain clouds swirled overhead. Hannah buttoned up the collar of her gray raincoat and tried to keep warm as a cold mist splashed across her face. She was alone and face to face once again with the camp of death, the hellhole that devastated the lives of millions of innocent Jews, Auschwitz. Her stomach churned. She felt nauseated and trembling in fear. But Hannah knew she had to finally confront the demons that had stolen her life so many years ago. The steel front gates, faded and chipped from the many years of weather and erosion, still announced in big, bold letters, quote, Auschwitz, Birkenau II. Below the welcome sign was Arbeit macht frei, meaning work brings freedom. Hannah steadied her balance and leaned against the steel gate, feeling dizzy. Auschwitz was anything but freedom. It was a pit of fear, death, and oppression. It was a place of unimaginable cruelty where the crime of the century had taken place. Composing herself, Hannah took a deep, agonizing breath and struggled to continue. Passing through the front gate, Hannah gazed at the endless barbed wire fence that surrounded the death camp. The guard tower still stood towering above the fence, broken and displaying years of weather erosion. Hannah remembered that near the many end, prisoners, despaired of hope, hurled their bodies against the barbed wire and were instantly electrocuted, ending their lives and escaping from the horrible, unjust suffering. The ground was still muddy. Hannah remembered the endless hours of standing in the rain and cold for roll call until every prisoner was accounted for. Many of the prisoners, weak and ill, collapsed from standing at attention and died from exhaustion. In a matter of minutes, Jewish prisoners were ordered to dispose of the body and haul them away in a wooden court. Hannah stopped. Drops of cold rain splashed across her face. The air was becoming cold. Hannah bundled up in her rain jacket. In the distance, Hannah could see row after row of the blockhouses out across the muddy grounds. The blockhouses were converted horse stables where thousands of prisoners were crammed together, sometimes four to a bunk, in filthy, poorly heated death houses. Hannah gazed at the palms of her hands and remembered the cracks, the sores, and blisters that tormented her from breaking rocks and bricks every day. The hard labor began at 6 a.m. and lasted sometimes until 7 p.m. that same night, enduring back-breaking, intense work with very little food and water. She witnessed many of her friends collapsing and dying from disease and exhaustion after laboring 13 hours a day. It began raining harder. The wind was whipping across Hannah's face. She bundled up tightly in her raincoat. Over to the left was an ominous and painful sight. Hannah gazed at the steel railroad tracks that ran up to the entrance of Auschwitz. Although faded by the weather and many years of soiled erosion, the steel tracks still shined as a grim reminder of the thousands of Jews that were transported like cattle from far away in Warsaw. Hannah stepped closer to the tracks, remembering how the Germans with their guard dogs seized the passengers out of their freight cars and divided them into two separate lines, one line for hard labor and the other line to immediate death in the gas chambers. Hannah recalled how she and Sophie fortunately were pushed together in the line for hard labor. "Oh, Sophie," Hannah mumbled to herself in tears, her voice trembling. "I miss you so much, dear friend." Hannah moved on toward the barracks. It was much too painful to dwell at the train tracks any longer. Bundling up against the weather, Hannah pushed open the door to the barracks. She walked inside and switched on a ceiling light. In front of her were old wooden barracks laden with cobwebs and spiders. The bunk beds towered three high up toward the ceiling. Hannah steadied herself against the railing of the bunk bed, overcome with grief. She remembered sleeping on the top bunk with Sophie and three other women squeezed together. Hannah could still hear the moaning, the cursing, and the coughing. Many of the other women were sick from not having food and water for three long and agonizing days. Tears of sorrow streamed down Hannah's face. She rubbed her eyes and began to pray, crying out in grief to Hashem. She remembered praying and comforting Gabriella at the first night at Auschwitz. Gabriella had watched her sister die in the freight car. The next morning when she had tried to wake up Gabriella, she remembered how cold her body was to touch. Gabriella had died during the night. Hannah stared down at the walls next to the bunk beds. Many prisoners had written or etched messages on the walls. "Welcome to hell. There is no escape. There is no God. There is no way out of here." Hannah turned her head away in despair. She felt an empty bitterness and sorrow flooding her soul. Facing her demons was more overwhelming than she had ever imagined. Hannah had to move on quickly. Stepping out of the barracks, Hannah was relieved to see that the rain had stopped. She looked ahead in the distance. There was a two-story building with chimneys on the roof. Hannah immediately recognized it. It was the place of hell and death. Sophie had been brought there one awful, grim, and rainy day. She had been escorted here with 50 other women to be gassed. Hannah grabbed her chest in anxiety. She felt her heart flutter as pains shot across her chest. She didn't know if she could endure going inside, but she knew she had to go on. Hannah wanted to once and for all confront the ultimate dark horrors at the Chamber of Horrors. Here is where her best friend died over 40 years ago. Hannah had to go and be with her this one last time to say goodbye and find closure. Shortly before the war ended, when the Germans realized they were going to lose, they destroyed most of the buildings containing the gas chambers in order to conceal their sick and despicable crimes against humanity. However, there was one building that still remained standing at Auschwitz, testifying to the unspeakable crimes that the Germans committed against innocent Jewish people. Hannah turned the handle on the door and walked inside. It was ominously quiet and vacant. She heard the sound of shoes squeaking as she stepped onto the shiny linoleum floor. Aside from a few dim ceiling lights, the corridor was shrouded in a dark and eerie glow. There was a sign and an arrow pointing toward a door indicating the location of the shower rooms where people were gassed. During an execution, a person was appointed to stand on the roof above and drop poisonous pellets down a metal chute, landing on the floor of the shower room below. Men, women, and children were ordered to strip naked and herded together into a fake shower room. Within a few minutes, tiny pellets struck the floor, and the room was engulfed in a poisonous cloud of gas, slowly suffocating the naked victims. Intense screaming and yelling could be heard beyond the shower walls as the victims desperately tried to breathe and stay alive. The ominous sound of footsteps descending down the stairs sent chills up and down Hannah's spine. She couldn't believe she was actually going down in the basement where thousands of Jews were murdered, and yet Hannah knew that she had to do this. Reaching the bottom, Hannah gazed at the dark and cold concrete walls. There was a tiny shaft of light above, illuminating the cold, death-like basement. Hannah was seized by cold chills as she stared ahead at the door in front of her. This was the room of death, the door that led to the shower room of merciless executions. Hannah began to tremble with fear. Behind that door was where her best friend Sophie bravely struggled for her survival more than 40 years ago and lost the battle. She had no chance of survival. She had been led like a lamb to the slaughter. Hannah stood in the dark corridor surrounded by four cold, cracked concrete walls that seemed to stare back at her as if she were the next victim. Suddenly, Hannah felt trapped, swelled. Sweat rolled down her forehead. Her heart began to race. Sophie! Sophie! Hannah cried out. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Hannah covered her face in tears. She couldn't open up the door. She felt guilty for being so broken and afraid. I wish I could have been here with you, Sophie, and held you in my arms. Please forgive me, Hannah sobbed intensely. Then in the midst of her agony, down in her sight of her spirit, a voice seemed to rise up and get her attention. Hannah, the voice gently said, beckoning her. Hannah, the voice said again. Hannah struggled to compose herself. Hannah, listen to me. Don't be afraid. Don't be sad anymore. Hannah slowly began to quiet down and stopped sobbing. Yeshua, Hannah replied. Yeshua, is that you? Suddenly, Hannah stopped sobbing. A river of peace seemed to pour down over her and cleanse her soul. She was no longer afraid. In her dying moments, I held Sophie in my arms. She is no longer afraid. She is now with me. Tears of joy flooded Hannah's eyes. Yes, yes, Yeshua, she is with you. Hannah, I know all about pain and suffering. I experienced rejection, betrayal, and excruciating death. Hannah, I gave my life for you and Sophie and millions of others. I embrace the worst of pain and suffering for your forgiveness. Hannah, don't weep or be afraid. I love you with an everlasting love. I am bringing beauty out of the ashes of your suffering. Hannah fell to her knees on the cold, hard, concrete floor in worship. In the midst of her intense suffering and pain, Yeshua had visited her in the hellhole where Sophie had died. All of the hurt and brokenness had suddenly melted away. Hannah felt healed and restored once again. She now knew that it was her time to move on. This is from my book, Beauty from the Ashes, The Promise Fulfilled. It is a beautiful story of how Hannah was able to find her long-lost brother by reading an old diary found in a crate box that was to be delivered to a museum for the Holocaust remembrance. This is a story that fulfills the first book. It's the sequel to The Promise. I wrote that scene after much research and watching many videos and trying to, in just a millisecond, understand some of the suffering and pain that the Jewish people endured in that horrific moment. And I wrote that in my book. This has been a very sober and serious program, but it is a program that I had to do today. It is a program that hopefully will educate us and will sound the message all over the world that we need to remember and never forget that this is an unforgettable dark cloud over humanity that must never happen again. No race of people should ever have to endure the horrible genocide that the Jewish people endured more than 70 years ago during the Holocaust. And so we must educate. We must speak out. We must remember and never forget. So I hope today that you will take this program and share this program with all of your friends. And especially tomorrow on the actual International Holocaust Remembrance Day, please take a picture. And please post it on Facebook, simply saying, we remember and we will never forget. I hope that this program has educated you. I hope that this program has inspired you to stand against racism, hatred, and discrimination and anti-Semitism in our world today. It has been a pleasure to bring you this program today. My name is Randy Noble. I will see you again on Monday for another edition of The Cross in the Desert. Have a great weekend.
Great.